welcome everyone to the National Federation of the Blind Indiana Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee's meeting here this month. And we really have some good information, great information to share. And I trust that you all can absorb it and take it back to your communities. And, you know, we all can learn more about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how we can be better and stronger advocates. And we hope that this session here allows you to do just that. As you know, our theme of this is the critical race theory, what it is and what it's not. And we will get to that. That will be our last item on our agenda. We will have Ms. Sarah Williams. She is the executive director of public policy and advocacy of McCoy, and her and Dr. Reed and the possibility of Ms. Amber O'Haver will come in and speak about a bill that's going through the state of Indiana. It's HB 1134, and it's in the Senate now, and we will talk a little bit about that bill, and then we'll go and speak with Mr. John Pear of NFB, Executive Director for Advocacy and Policy, and we also have a colleague of his, which is Jeff Kalock, and we will do some discussion there on how the NFB comes up with its priorities for our Washington seminar and how it can be helpful in resolutions and things within the state, and also maybe talk a little bit about the voting. And then right after that, we will have our own Dr. Yvette Simmons-Reed, and she will be speaking on the critical race theory, and we are opening up all of these areas or items for discussion. And we want you to feel free to raise your hand and join in the discussion. We will ask for questions after each one of the issues. So without any further delay here, I want to bring forth Ms. Sarah Williams. And Ms. Sarah Williams, I just want to say thank you once again for coming on and sharing with us today. And the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. Again, I'm Sarah Williams, Public Policy and Advocacy Director at Marion County Commission on Youth. I've been keeping quite busy this legislative session at the State House. In particular, we've been working quite a bit on House Bill 1134, which you may have heard about this from the news. It's been all over the news. This is one of the controversial education bills that's currently moving through the State House. It had kind of a companion bill in the Senate called Senate Bill 167, which was almost identical. That bill has since died, but it did receive national attention when Senator Scott Baldwin made the statement that when teaching things such as Nazism, one must remain partial when teaching that. And so that received a ton of backlash and everything. It was made fun of on the Stephen Colbert Show, made national news. And so because of that, that bill died. But regardless, 1134 still exists. It's nearly identical. And it's currently legislators are working hard to get it to a place where it will pass through the State House and be sent to the governor to put into law. I will say this week, there's been a lot of action taking place on the bill. It's already passed through the House. It was introduced in the Senate Committee on Education and Career Development. And they met actually yesterday to discuss it. They heard public testimony. They also amended it. They amended it significantly, which is a good thing, trying to make it a little bit more palatable in terms of, you know, what it allows and what it doesn't allow. They removed some provisions that were especially made teachers afraid. In particular, it was basically, just a bit of background of it. It was introduced kind of in response to fear that things like critical race theory are being taught in schools. And you may have heard, you know, on the news that like over the course of, earlier this school year, there were a lot of people interrupting school board meetings and things like that for fear that their children are being indoctrinated and that CRT is being taught in schools and things like that. And they would, you know, interrupt school board meetings. And so It's the same group of people who are going now to the legislative level to try and create change that way, to make sure that there's more transparency in terms of what is being taught in schools. And so basically, originally what the bill would have required would be to add this additional level of monitoring of teachers, where they would have to post every part of their curriculum online for parents to be able to access and review. It would create committees made of parents and members of the public to review all of the curricular materials each year. Teachers would have to have all of their curriculum approved in order to teach it, which would, you know, keep them from making last minute adjustments and things like that, especially in response to just things that happen in the world every day. You know, they wouldn't be able to really discuss that. It would also instill a lot of fear, and it still instills a lot of fear in teachers, even after these amendments, that basically, you know, if they're teaching something about race or history or some of the horrors of our past, originally before it was amended, basically, if it was an issue that made a child feel uncomfortable, whether it's, you know, a white child feeling uncomfortable listening to the horrors of slavery, for example, then a parent could make a complaint, and a teacher could risk losing his or her license, getting fired, getting sued. And so that created, you know, this huge fear of censorship of teachers. I will say that particular part has been removed. There were a lot of amendments that were made recently to make it a little bit better, but it still has a lot of holes missing. Another thing that's also especially frustrating is the fact that legislators haven't really consulted with many people aside from these frustrated parents about the ins and outs of, you know, what this legislation would mean. And so, you know, even with all of the adjustments and things like that they've made, I've sat in on conversations with teachers who are in the classrooms doing the work and are the experts in their fields. And they say, well, what about this situation? Or what about this particular class I'm teaching? Would it apply to this? And there's just a lot of missing pieces, and legislators don't seem to be taking those into account. And so, you know, we appreciate the efforts made to try to improve this bill that were introduced and amended into the bill yesterday. We appreciated that, but ultimately this bill is still not passable. It's not, I don't think it will ever be in a place that's kind of good enough to make teachers feel protected. And it's just, you know, an added frustration too. You know, it seems like every year teachers are out there trying to defend themselves and defend the work that they do and ask for more resources and things like that. And it's just this constant attack on teachers. Now, I will say, you know, it significantly affects teachers, but it also significantly affects students and the services that they're able to get. One huge issue that still remains in this bill is mental health services for students. You know, in schools, sometimes that's the only place where students can get certain help. And the bill currently as written would require parental permission for students to receive mental health services in schools. And what they're not realizing, what legislators are not realizing, is the fact that sometimes these mental health issues are stemming from the parents and from what parents are doing at home. And so, you know, kids might not want to have their parental permission and everything like that. And there was actually some really powerful testimony about students who were contemplating suicide, who were able to go to a trusted adult at their school to be able to seek help and seek support in that way. You know, there are all sorts of services, and it's not even medical, you know, services or anything like that, but just clubs that, you know, students can be a part of that address mental health issues. And those, you know, you'd have to have that parental permission to be a part of that. You know, there was originally fear that even if a student were to come into the classroom crying and looking visibly upset, the teacher would feel a little nervous in terms of whether or not they could ask, hey, what's wrong? Is everything all right? So that's something that I imagine they'll probably work on changing, but it's something that is still a part of the bill. And so, you know, we really want to raise some awareness about that. Now, I was asked to speak a little bit on the effects of this bill on students with disabilities. I will just kind of give you a bit of background. I'm certainly not an expert in the disability aspect of it, but I do have a colleague who did raise a few issues with me that he wanted me to make sure to include to share with you all is, first of all, it's not clear whether or not 1134 is legal with respect to FERPA IDEA and those the confidentiality aspects, because many classes, including students with disabilities, are small, some of which are less than 5 students. And so if teachers are required to submit all of their educational materials, they'll presumably also need to identify where they've made these instructional accommodations for students who are served in special ed classes. And, you know, if there are very few children in the class, it could be possible to identify those individual students, which would be, you know, obviously not acceptable. So that's one big issue. Another thing is that there's a list of protected classes listed in the bill. I just pulled it up. Basically, it would protect, there are 3 tenets of the bill saying that you cannot promote the concept as part of a course or instruction, that promote the concept. Sorry, I'm kind of reading the bill also as I'm talking to you. Basically, a teacher could not promote the concept that any sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin is inherently superior or inferior to another one of those protected classes. It also, there's another one, you cannot promote the concept that those same classes, that an individual should be treated adversely or preferentially because of those classes. And also, you cannot teach that those classes that I mentioned are inherently responsible for actions committed in the past by other members of those classes. Again, the classes that are identified are sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin. What you may have noticed is it does not include disability status. It also doesn't include LGBTQ students, and it doesn't include students who speak different languages. So with that missing piece, you know, it leaves one to wonder, is it okay to advocate discrimination against those groups? So that's, you know, another missing piece in there. And my colleague said, and I agree with him, that he's come to realize that there simply isn't a group that this bill doesn't harm, which is why, you know, I'm really glad that you guys reached out to me to learn more about the bill. I will say, in all of the advocacy efforts that I have seen, this particular perspective of the concerns for students with disabilities, I don't think has really been raised. And so I think that, you know, I would welcome you and invite you to definitely join our advocacy efforts in against this bill, and to especially share your perspective and your experiences and your concerns, in particular with how it would affect the disability community. Because I think that that's incredibly important for legislators to hear. So as I mentioned, there was testimony heard yesterday on the bill. It went a really long time. But it was quite inspiring because, you know, there were just so many people there, in particular teachers. ISTA has done a lot of organizing to get teachers from all over the state to show up to testify and, you know, defend themselves. And so testimony, they ended up cutting it off after about an hour and 45 minutes hearing testimony. I would say well over half of the people who asked to testify were not given a chance, unfortunately. So they did decide to hold the bill. They have not yet voted on it in committee because they want to do some additional tweaks and everything. And so, so there's still a chance for changes. There's still a chance to, you know, advocate against this bill. They will probably, I think they're scheduled to bring it up for a vote in that committee this upcoming Wednesday now, which I think is the 23rd. Let me see. Yes, Wednesday the 23rd. I think they're going to schedule to discuss it then. I'm wondering if they're going to allow for testimony. I think they should, because they didn't hear everybody who showed up, and there were a lot of people who needed to be heard. Who didn't have that chance. And so I'm not sure if they're going to be hearing testimony, but regardless if they are or not, you know, people are going to definitely be at the state house protesting, trying to talk to their legislators, or their senators, to ask them to oppose the bill. So that's kind of where it's at right now. I'd welcome to hear your thoughts on it too. Cause as I said, you know, I've been learning so much about the bill and about exactly, you know, how it affects everybody from all different backgrounds and perspectives. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. or, you know, any concerns you have. And also, you know, if we can work together, hopefully, over the next few weeks to hopefully defeat the bill. So, yeah, that's kind of my
Thank you so much, Sarah. That's exactly what we're interested in doing. If I might just make a couple of comments. You mentioned that this bill is purported to make education more transparent. And for most school districts, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the academic core standards are posted for the state because that was legislated. And so all of that is always available. Mm-hmm. And the content that needs to be taught is always available as it relates to each of those standards. Am I right on that?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, and that's something too that, yeah, teachers have been saying is, you know, they're happy to share what they want or what, you know, parents ask of them on an individual basis. It's just that added requirement.
Right. Well, it's unnecessary drawing of resources, both human and, you know, and otherwise. The other thing that I might say is that the curriculum in terms of books and textbooks that's used in K-12 is not a decision made by teachers alone. Mm-hmm. Specifically, there's also a mechanism in place that decides the curriculum for any particular level of education, whether it's kindergarten, all that. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, and as it relates to, and I don't want to take time, I want other people to ask questions, but as it relates to special education, I agree with your colleague that this bill fundamentally jeopardizes funding of special ed in the state of Indiana for the fact that the conditions by the state is to offer a free and appropriate public education based on the child's needs. So if a child needs mental health support, then that is exactly what needs to happen. And for I've taught all levels of education, and I believe to the greatest extent possible, schools seek parents' permission before they implement things with children, you know, especially if a child is in distress. But there are times when, like as you mentioned, and mentioned appropriately, that for the safety of a child, it's not appropriate to perhaps, especially if a child does not want the parents involved at that moment because of their own safety.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
You know, this is some very good discussion here, and we just have a few more minutes that we can allow for any other questions from the audience. So you can just raise your hand if you have a question regarding the issue.
While we wait for those, this is Michael Off. My question would be, is this something that you're prepared to challenge in the courts if it's passed and signed into law?
That's a good question. I will say my organization, McCoy, or Marion County Commission on Youth, I don't believe we have the capacity to do that, but it wouldn't surprise me if the Indiana State Teachers Association would do something mm-hmm. like that. Yeah.
I think Maryland raised.
Maryland, okay.
Maryland, did you have a question?
And we must say that this type of...
Go ahead, Marilyn.
She's there. Okay.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you all from Indiana for allowing those of us from other states to participate this evening. We're facing the same challenge here in Florida, and it's very, very disheartening. I never thought I would live to see the day that this kind of racial, really oppression would be present in our public school system. And I just hope that this is something that we could work on as a federation, because it does affect members of our diversity and inclusion family in the NFB. And I don't see this as helping children to have a well-rounded education. It is really, really sad. What about the children whose parents or grandparents faced discrimination, lived through slavery, and they feel discomfort? They are possibly helped as they're allowed to talk about the discrimination that they have experienced or their forefathers have experienced. But obviously, this isn't addressed now.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you made the point. And I didn't realize that there were people here from out of state. So Welcome. That's really great. But yeah, this is something that we've been seeing like all over the country. I think there have been efforts to create, you know, these school transparency bills. And I want to say something like 36 states so far and counting.
Yes.
And yeah, it's scary stuff. And, you know, I think it stems from fear. I think fear of like, I don't know, the unknown, fear of, or this like distrust in teachers. And ultimately, yeah, it's exactly what, Evelyn said, or excuse me, Marilyn said, that, you know, this will affect students significantly in terms of what, if, you know, their ability to think critically, their ability to ask questions and to, you know, expand their minds and to, you know, really understand where we've come from and how we can try to, you know, not replicate the mistakes of our past. So, yeah.
I appreciate the questions and in respect to time and our other presenters. We must move on, but we must say at the same time that this kind of segues right into our next presenter, that is Mr. John Pear, and he once again he's the National Federation of the Blind Executive Director for Advocacy and Policy, and we also have with him Mr. Jeff Kellogg, and then we'll discuss NFB process of voting rights and how members can take action in the resolution process. As you see, it's with things on legislation being proposed like this throughout the country, it is very vital that we know how to take action within the confines of our organizations. And Mr. John Pear, he will kind of share with us on how we coordinate this, these types of actions and how they become, priorities. So, Mr. John Pear, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Lee. Thank you so much for, excuse me, getting off over a little cough. Thank you for inviting me to speak. And I'll go over to Jeff in a few minutes. Jeff is one of our government affairs specialists, and he's the one working on our voting efforts together with Luann Blake. All right. So, now maybe I'm going to start from some high level and get to more detail. One of the things Lee said to begin with was a little bit about how we pick what we issues we work on, especially at the federal level. The methodology for doing that at the state level is very similar, except that you do it affiliate by affiliate. All right. So at the national level, there's first thing very important to remember is that the National Convention of the National Federation of Blind is the supreme authority of the NFB. And so our resolutions are what determine our policy. President Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind, will sometimes say, you know, that's his to-do list. That's our policy determined by our National Convention. Anyone can submit a resolution for consideration to the resolution's chair, which is currently Sharon Maneki. And she usually puts out an announcement to remind people the deadlines associated with that, which is currently, I think, 30 days, maybe before the National Convention, specifically the resolutions meeting at National Convention. That has to be submitted. We usually do some review to fix any possible technical errors so that the resolution doesn't fail due to a technical error, which usually the authors appreciate, but no edit is forced on them. And then the resolution will come up at the resolutions committee meeting. And if it passes there, it goes to the full floor. And if it passes there, it becomes our policy. Failing to pass a resolution doesn't mean the opposite. If you fail to pass a resolution, it means really nothing. It just didn't pass. But when you pass it, do pass a resolution, it's now considered our policy. all of our resolutions, certainly the current ones and going back 30 or 40 years, maybe all the way back to 1940, are posted on our website. They're always published in the Braille monitor because we want to make sure that these people are aware of our resolutions. So we put them on the website, we put them on the Braille monitor. Of course, the Braille monitor is available also on our website and available on NFB Newsline. And then depending on who they're directed to, say they're directed to the Department of Education, then we would typically mail the resolution with a cover letter to the Secretary of Education, or if it's directed to Congress, we would mail it maybe to Speaker Pelosi or Majority Leader Schumer or to Mitch McConnell or to McCarthy, the minority leader on the House side. Kind of depends where some are oriented to companies, sometimes tech companies, so we send it to them and so forth. So we make sure that those get distributed, not just within the NFB, but they get distributed to the target audience, depending on what we are asking for. So that's that policy portion. In addition, throughout the year, at every affiliate convention, President Riccobono either attends that or sends a representative who, talks to members, to the affiliate leadership and to members, and is always, reports back to President Riccobono. What do our members want? What are they saying? What's of interest to them? You're welcome to write President Riccobono anytime you want. His email is Office of the President, all one word, Office of the President at NFB.org. And of course, you're also welcome to write me, but I'm not the president, but you're welcome to write me. My email is JPARE at NFB.org. So I want to make sure you know that the lines of communication are open with ideas that you might have. And that goes for all of our members. So we're all year long collecting ideas about what are the problems that we need to try to solve to improve the lives of blind people. And of course, do as we would say, live the lives we want. This comes to kind of a focal point in the, at the national board meeting that usually occurs on or about Thanksgiving weekend. Typically right now the schedule is typically the weekend after Thanksgiving. The national board then makes a final determination based on a number of factors, which I can talk a little bit about what issues should be involved in the upcoming Washington seminar. And then they make a final recommendation, they being the national board, to President Riccobono, and then President Riccobono makes the final decision. And then we, at that point, we have the issues and they're normally announced a week or two after that. Sometimes there's some research that needs to be done and we start working on fact sheets and we get the fact sheets on the web as quickly as we can, typically the first week of January, so that people now are aware of those. One, I would say, thing I want to emphasize is while certain issues we think will benefit from the Washington seminar focus, don't think for a second that that's the only thing we work on. Right now, the Washington seminar issues were the Access Technology Affordability Act, which I won't try to describe all these because I think it'll take up too much time. So I'm going to kind of assume you know that, or you can look at the website. So the Access Technology Affordability Act, Medical Device Non-Visual Accessibility Act, the 21st Century Website and Application Accessibility Act, and the Transformation of Competitive Integrated Employment Act. Those four issues. Then and they're not in an, that's not a priority order. It just helps me remember them to have an order to them. So I order them and I encourage other people to order them, but only so it helps us stay organized. It's not a priority. They're all a priority. And then the other ones, they're also a priority. I would say the next one I like to keep organized is voting. That's both at the federal and state level. And I'm going to come back to that. Then we're doing Social Security, both the earnings cliff for SSDI, the changing the waiting period. We've been talking a lot. You know, we have to wait 5 months before we start collecting. If you are eligible for SSDI and you're determined eligible, you still have to wait 5 more months after your eligibility date to start collecting. That's ridiculous. We shouldn't have to do that. And then there's some of the reach back on the penalties are absolutely horrible. And we have a national resolution on that should be changed with a recommendation on how we should do that. So we We're working the Social Security issues, working on transportation issues. One of the ones we're spending a lot of time right now, because it's so much at the stage it's at, is the restrictions with guide dogs on airlines. That's one. Two would be the number of times that people with guide dogs are refused access to rideshare, Uber and Lyft, and trying to figure out how we do something about that. The very poor performance of paratransit, another issue. Lack of mass transit, another issue. Some problems we're having with Amtrak. That's might not be as much as an issue in Indiana, because I don't know that you have so much Amtrak service, but it's quite an issue in some other places. And then maybe more very positive thing, trying to make sure that fully automated vehicles will also be something that we can operate, that they're non-visually accessible in some of the work that we're doing. Those are all things we're doing under the general topic of transportation. The some of the other kind of highly specialized things is some things we're doing with to try to prevent rest area commercialization that would dramatically impact and negatively impact our Randolph Shepherd vendors. That's probably the largest number of Randolph Shepherd vendors as far as the type of location is at rest stops, and we're working hard to make sure that those are protected and those Randolph Shepherd vendors can do well. And then there's, I didn't bring my list right with, there's several others, but that gives you an idea of the, well, oh no, I do remember the other two. Education, I can't know how I can mention that after that great presentation about that problems with that bill, which very big problems. And this is the Individuals with Disability Education Act reauthorization that's being considered. This is the bill that creates the idea that you have to, that not the idea, it creates the law and the requirement that people with disabilities have to receive a full and appropriate public education. It also creates that you have to do it in the least restrictive environment. Two things that we care a lot about, we at the National Federation of Blind: free and appropriate public education and the least restrictive environment. Also, higher ed reauthorization is coming up, and we want to be focused on that to try to improve opportunities in higher education. The I use the term reauthorization. These laws, typically like IDEA or the Higher Education Act, are every 5 to 10 years renegotiated and updated. And so this is an opportunity for us to make things better, and certainly to make sure they don't get worse. So the reauthorizations are, it's very important that we pay attention to those. And they're a little cyclical in that, for right now, for example, there's very little work being done on the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act reauthorization. This is at the federal level, so we don't need to put so much attention into that. When that starts to move, that will become a top issue for us. Same with higher ed reauthorization. All right, now some of the things you might wonder, what have we been doing in terms of some of the, especially the federal level voting, and maybe touching on the state level. Jeff really is the best person to talk about that. So turning it over to you, Jeff.
Thank you, John. Before I get into what we're doing at the given moment, I want to mention two principles at the NFB that we advocate for in general when it comes to voting. The first one is, as many of you are aware of, especially during the past few years, remote voting has really caught momentum in the sense that a lot of states are, you know, permitting it, and people are able to vote remotely and not in a polling place. And at the NFB, our policy is with remote voting is, you know, pretty straightforward. If anyone else, if it should be able, you know, a blind person should be able to vote remotely, both privately and independently. And in order to do that, there's a process called electronic delivery and electronic return. Delivery is where you would have the ballot delivered to you, whether it's through a PDF or a portal or whatever the mechanism may be, but it will be delivered to your home electronically, where you're able to access the ballot. And then also when you have the ballot, you're able to mark it, cast it, and also verify who you voted for, all in the process while you're returning the ballot. So those two components are, you know, that component is very important. From the beginning process, we want to make sure that everyone's allowed to, privately and independently register, mark, cast, and verify, as I mentioned, your ballot. So with electronic delivery and return, that's a key principle we look for with remote voting. Now, we understand that not everyone has the means or the bandwidth or whatever, you know, the mechanisms to vote remotely. So in-person voting is still a high priority as well. And when it comes to in-person voting, the Help America Vote Act that was passed in the early 2000s permitted that each polling location has a ballot marking device. And, you know, ballot marking devices, as helpful as they've been, and with the Help America Vote Act ensuring that there's at least one in each polling place, they still come with their flaws. One of those being, oftentimes, these devices aren't set up from the beginning of the election day. Mm-hmm. The poller will go into the polling location and the poll workers won't even have it set up. And when a blind voter comes in, they go, you know, they hit the panic button. They think, oh, we got to set this up now. And it shouldn't be that case. It should be set up when the polls open, whether it's, you know, 7 a.m. or 8 a.m., whatever the time is that the polls open, those devices should be operational at that point. So that's the first part. Secondly, we want to make sure that the poll workers are properly trained on these devices. So, you know, if a blind user needs assistance with it, or if there's, you know, a glitch in the system that needs to be corrected, or if, you know, anything that would happen with the polling, with the ballot marking device, we want to make sure that the poll workers properly train and how to use them. And then lastly, because there's only one ballot marking device and it's often only used when a blind or print disabled voter enters the polling location, they print a ballot that's in different size and texture than a hand marked paper ballot that is in size and texture. So what this does, it doesn't provide secrecy to the ballot. So if you were the one blind person who went into that particular precinct and used the ballot marking device and you printed your ballot out that way, and everyone else in that precinct is using hand marked paper ballots, it's going to be very distinguishable to tell that, you know, this one ballot came from the one person who used the ballot marking device. And then they're going to be able to see who you voted for and, you know, and everything like that. And the secrecy of your vote is no longer confidential. You know, it's the confidentiality of the vote is pretty much gone at that point. So those are the principles that we're trying to correct when we speak about in-person voting, to ensure that poll workers are, the machines are set up from the start of the day, poll workers are properly trained, and that there's a secrecy of the ballot. And one of the solutions to this is have more people, whether they're disabled or not disabled, use the ballot marking devices. This will make sure that the machines are operational from the beginning, because they're going to be expecting everyone to use them. Poll workers will be more familiar with them as more people are using them, and they'll become better equipped to manage them. And there'll be more ballots printed from from the ballot marking devices, therefore providing some secrecy to the ballot for the voters that are using them. So these are the two principles, whether it's in-person or remote voting, that we advocate for, whether it's on a federal level or on a state level. And back in the beginning of 2021, Congress was looking at passing voting reform legislation in the form of H.R. 1 or S. 1. And we at the National Federation of the Blind, we were very persistent in our advocacy efforts to include the provisions that I mentioned, to make sure that in-person voting contained the components that I mentioned, as well as remote voting. And we were advocating to the extent that we actually got an amendment into H.R. 1. Unfortunately, it was removed and a little bit watered down towards the end, that it didn't really contain the provisions that we would like it to contain. And H.R. 1 ended up passing, and it went over to the Senate, where the Senate was debating it. And currently in the Senate, for those that are following politics, or for those that aren't, There's a stalemate when it comes to this particular issue with voting, and the bill required a 60 votes in the Senate in order to pass, and currently there's only about 50 votes that they can garner for this particular bill. So we, in that sense, there's a stalemate on the federal level that's not going to allow the passage of this bill. Now, that doesn't mean we still weren't trying to advocate for the provisions that we wanted in this bill up until the last moment. until the bill ultimately didn't pass, because you never know in that given sense it could pass. They could find the 10 votes somewhere to make sure this legislation passes. So, we at the National Federation of the Blind, we're still advocating up to the last moment to get these provisions in there, whether it was electronic ballot delivery and return or the provisions that I had mentioned about in-person voting. Unfortunately, we were not able to include them in that larger piece of legislation, the For the People Act. Now, Congress is still working to try to get voting rights legislation passed. They've come up with a couple different bills. And most recently, what they have done is they combined two bills together. They combined the Freedom to Vote Act, which is basically the For the People Act, just with a different name, and also the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And they took both of these bills and put them together in what they're calling the Freedom to Vote John Lewis Act. And, we're still advocating to get the provisions that we would like to see for in-person and for remote voting in this particular piece of legislation. Unfortunately, none of these bills are going to be passing in the Senate. It's just a stalemate right now, which leads me to my next point. Just because there's a stalemate on the federal level doesn't mean we give up. We still advocate at the federal level, but we also have to understand that if legislation's not going to move on a federal level, then we need to go to the state level, because there's still going to be elections happening at the end of this year. And we want to make sure that blind voters can vote both privately and independently. So Liam, my colleague Luann Blake and I, we have been working with various states at the state level to advocate for these provisions of remote voting and in-person voting on a state-by-state basis. And, to the extent that we, even with particular states, we have weekly or biweekly meetings with them on their progress and what they need to do and what the next steps are to ensure that voters in their blind and print disabled voters in their states can vote both with privacy and with the independence. So that's what we've been working on. And, by all means, we'd be more than happy to work with, Indiana and see where you guys are at. We write usually to the Board of Election. We try to engage with them or the Secretaries of State. There's different ways, though, that legislation could be passed on a state level. Massachusetts and North Carolina, they were able to get electronic ballot delivery and return through court orders. They use the cases basically that since UOCAVA voters that are voters, that's military and overseas voters, were using this system to vote overseas remotely with electronic delivery and return, that it was discriminatory that voters with disabilities were not able to use that same practice or that same method. So in those two particular states in 2020, they were granted the right to vote remotely using electronic ballot delivery and return. Now, other states, they pass legislation and go through the state senate and the state delegation and then all the way up to the governor to pass legislation. And Colorado is one of those states that has recently done that. And the legislators that were advocating for these particular bills, they were getting pushback. But they, we educated them on the issue and why some of the resistance they were getting wasn't what the people that were opposing it thought it was. So we kind of gave them ways to navigate the opposition and work in a way that they could get this legislation passed and ultimately into law. And now Colorado is able, voters that are blind and print disabled in Colorado can vote they can vote remotely using electronic ballot delivery and return. So, we're always trying to be crafty in a way that our end goal is just to make sure that blind voters can vote in that manner. Like I said, whether it's through a court order, whether it's through legislation, you name it, we're just trying to get it done and we're going to use anything at our disposal to do so.
All right. I really certainly appreciate your presentations there. Are there any questions? You can please raise your hand and ask any questions on this issue.
Just as a point of privilege here, since there's no hand raised right now. Jeff, I have a question. What were some of the concerns expressed by the legislature in terms of the concerns that they have with remote voting?
Sure, yeah. So the concerns, the opposition that we usually face when it comes to electronic delivery and return is security concerns. Is it safe? Can it be done in a safe manner that it won't be hacked? You know, we've been using this sort of technology with especially UOCAVA voters, as I mentioned, military and overseas voters that have been using this since about 2008. And there haven't been any cases of fraud or, you know, election tampering or hacking. So of course, there's no proof that it's happened. But, you know, we want to make sure we're reasonable. We understand that, you know, there has to be security in our elections. And when we talk to IT specialists and election folks, Luann and I do, there actually are ways to do this in a safe manner that provides a blind and print disabled person a right to still vote privately and independently. And you know, and we try to describe them. There's different portals. There's encrypted PDFs. You know, whenever they bring up that there's security concerns, the first thing I look at is, well, what ways does their state allow them to vote? Because sometimes when they say this, their state will allow them to vote by fax, and fax is not safe at all. Fax can be very, tampered with. It can be, you know, it's not a safe way to cast a ballot per se. So when I, you know, hear their concerns, sometimes I look, you know, where are they actually coming from on this? Cause we want to make sure we reach a resolution with them or a compromise with them to say, like, look, we understand we too want to make sure that, you know, no one's vote is tampered with and that it's safe and secure. That's a, you know, a legit, concern. But there are ways to do it. So our, you know, especially like in Colorado, when we were facing pushback from some of the folks that were saying it can't be done in a way that's safe and secure, we had to have experts come in as well saying, yes, it can, and here's how, and explain to the legislators and explain to the Board of Election how it could be done and how other states are doing. Because actually there are six or seven states, that are voting this way for voters with disabilities, that are allowing electronic delivery and return.
Jeff, maybe just throw in that the opposition, the security, sometimes you call them the security hawks, can be really relentless. So there can be some very substantial opposition. So I don't want to leave people thinking that this is easy. It can be quite challenging. And some of the states we have not yet been, you know, many states we haven't been successful. We're not stopping, but it's challenging. Would you agree with that, Jeff?
Yeah, because the term we use, security hawks or security personnel, it all goes by theory. Because obviously, as I mentioned, there haven't been any cases where there's been any hacking or tampering or, you know, anything of that nature. So it all goes to theory. And when you bring up a theory, could it be hacked? Could this happen? I mean, you could bring up a theory for almost any election. Could someone, you know, go into a polling location and throw in a bunch of hand marked paper ballots? Theoretically, I guess they could. Is it likely? Probably not. You know, we're always working ourselves against things of that nature, and we have to prove to them, sure, anything, I guess, could happen in theory per se, but we want to make sure that the probability of that theory is very low to the point where it's not going to mess up an election results.
All righty. Are there any other questions before we move on?
This is Michael Off. I wanted to ask if you ever looked at like the Australian model where the public in general and the blind community, they've been able to vote online or via their telephone since 2010.
No, I wasn't aware of the Australian model. I know there's several countries. The examples I always often hear are countries in Eastern Europe that were former parts of the Soviet Union that vote using electronic delivery and return. And typically people, you know, you would think that those would be the countries that perhaps Russia would like to hack if they were going to hack anyone. And typically those countries have very low fraud cases and very low election tampering. So, I mean, I think cases like that prove that even in, you know, different countries, like you mentioned, Australia too, that this can be done. And, you know, even through an international basis where other countries are trying to influence their elections.
I guess I had a follow-up question. You mentioned that there are ways to protect it similar to the military and what folks overseas have been doing for many years. Is there somewhere, if we are advocating for the electronic, I mean, the remote voting here in the state of Indiana, and we want to provide that information, is that available to us?
Yeah, absolutely. What we could do is, Luann and I, we usually have different, what we could do is send you the legislation that other states have, mm-hmm. who have electronic ballot delivery and return have mm-hmm. used. Colorado is one of our gold standards right now because how they worked with the legislative process. If you want to take, you know, that we always like to go the legislative route first, yes. try to work with the state. So we'd be more than happy to send you some of the bill texts and what they have done in Colorado to move forward with that.
That sounds like that would be a great start here in the state of Indiana. And I know here in Indiana we go they want to go county by county on how we use the voting processes, which makes it kind of difficult with 90 or so counties. So that goes comes directly from the Secretary of State that we need to contact here. And I'm sure that our president, Diane Graves, wouldn't mind taking a look into this endeavor. And
I'm Brown.
Okay, Ron Brown, go ahead.
Yes, sir. guys, we had this issue at our state convention about 2 years ago. If you guys remember, the American Council for the Blind, the National Federation of the Blind, the Secretary of State's office all got together and we wrote up a proposal along with disability rights, wrote up a proposal about voting rights. And we had the team that came in, I believe they was at our national convention. They spoke about accessible voting machines and things of that. And they came and spoke at our convention as well. So we have that information, and if you need us to send it back out, we can.
Thank you very much, Ron Brown.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I'm from the state of Mississippi, and Jeff and John, I just want to thank you for the information you shared. It's good to have current information on how the resolution process works and to know the status of what is going on across the country with voting. So I just want to say thank you for sharing.
Welcome.
Okay, and we need to get together here with our board members here in the state of Indiana and follow up on those where we're at with our voting initiative. So I'm certain that we will be doing that here in the state of Indiana and be reaching back out to you guys in the very near future. So just want to thank you all for taking your time and sharing such valuable information. And I know we have other questions there. I know I have a few others, but I'll just wait till later to ask those questions. So in respect to time, we're going to thank you once again, and we're going to move forward here. We're going to move forward to Dr. Yvette Simmons-Reed, and she will be talking about how these bills are being impacted by disabled citizens. She spoke on it briefly, and how that goes into and impacts the critical race theory. So, Dr. Reed, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you very much. I really appreciate all of you being here, our speakers and folks from around, across Indiana and around the country. You know, we hear a lot on TV about critical race theory and all this other stuff. And, you know, people wonder, you know, what's true, what's not true. I want to first just kind of put some, clarify or make some connections. I'm one who speak pretty direct, and so I don't want you to miss it while you're here. The reason why we had Sarah on and John and Jeff today, you may think, well, what does the school bill in Indiana have to do with voting, and why would you put those two together? Well, we know, as Sarah mentioned, it's our school boards, okay, that makes decisions typically, okay, for our school districts. And our school board members are elected. So we must have the right to vote in order to elect those people who represent our interests. And given that this is Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Committee, we want to make sure that the interests of a diverse population, which is what this country was built on, have appropriate and proper representation in from our local, state, and national level. So voting is important. And I think, we become complacent sometimes and think the only election matters is the national election. Well, what's going on right now across this country is evidence of why it is so critical that we pay attention to all elections. And so I just wanted to make that statement real quickly. I want to do a quick little activity before we get started, because I know the topic that I'm talking about tonight is can be very divisive or raise concerns by folks. And that's not our purpose here. We want to have a dialogue. My goal is always to not tell you what to think, but give you some things to think about as we go along here. So there's no indoctrination going on. We just want to educate and give you some things to think about. So the first thing I want to start with is let's think about what we value. What do we value? Earlier today, I had an opportunity to participate in our Provost Summit. And in this Provost Summit, there's colleges across the state of Indiana. It's sponsored by LEAP Indiana. And they bring together higher ed faculty across the state to, you know, talk about things that impact higher education. And due to the pandemic, one of the things that we've been, you know, really focused on is student bandwidth, cognitive capacity. In 2020, many of our students, the schools were shut down. You know, whichever side of the you're on in terms of the school shutting down, they shut down, and so students did not have access to education. Many of our students, did not have online, virtual internet and all that stuff. So many schools went out of their way to try to make that happen. We still today have a significant number of students not in schools because of the pandemic, because of health issues and all that stuff. So, there's some things that are going on. But getting back to my point in terms of what we value and bandwidth, we know that bandwidth or the capacity to think about other things impacts learning, okay? So if you are poor, if you are hungry, if you have daycare issues, now come on, you guys. Some of you are dealing with this, trying to teach your kids and do your job at the same time, at home, because of the daycare issues, daycare shortages, or schools being shut down. Some of you, are struggling with taking care of family members who are sick from COVID. Okay. And trying to work and trying to care for your children. So we all are struggling with this bandwidth issue, in order to, make it every day. So one of the things we talked about was, some of that is thinking about what we value, and I'm putting it in that context. I'm putting it in that context because there's a lot of divisiveness, and a lot of folks using the fears of some, like Sarah mentioned, that there's a fear that, kids are going to be indoctrinated, whatever that means, taught something that they shouldn't be taught. And there are others who know very well that's not happening, but they're utilizing that to continue this divisiveness. So tell me about some values. What do you value? You can unmute. I need two or three people. Just tell me some things that you value and why you value them. Now, I'm thinking about family, religion, education, prosperity. Tell me some things you value.
Well, anyone can unmute if they need to, but this is Michael Off. I value independent living, and that might sound strange, but when you think of the cost, or, you know, for some people that's issues of discrimination or questions of their competency come into play. But to me, I don't take that for granted. I think about that. Be able to live where I want, but have to make compromises because, you know, I need to be able to have groceries delivered, or, you know, there's things you have to make choice about, especially if you want to live more rural as opposed to being in a larger urban metropolitan area.
So you value being able to take care of yourself and live independently.
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else?
Ron Brown. Yes, I value family. I value financial independence. I also value my work and what it means to me to be able to go to work every day.
Why is that? Why do you value those things?
I value those things because, number one, family is important to me because if you have a support when all else, well, and I'll just put it in context of myself, when all things have failed around me, my family was always there to support me, pick me up by my bootstraps, tell me it was going to be all right, and continue to move forward. And so I really value that support system around me, which is family. I value financial independence simply because I know that we live in a capitalistic society and money means independence. And having that helps me, especially as a blind man, to get security within my life and into my family. I value my work ethics because, number one, a lot of my self-esteem and my self-worth is tied up into my work. And so, therefore, feeling good about myself gives me an opportunity to get out and participate in the world and be a contributing factor in this society instead of feeling like I'm just a blemish on society, or I have to be taken care of. So that financial independence and my self-worth is tied up into my work ethics.
And thank you for that. That was excellent. So valuing your family, because that's your backbone. Those are the people that you know that support you. You have that circle of support no matter what you do, you know, that unconditional love. Right. And then I heard you say that you value your financial, you know, prosperity or wealth in order to not only because we live in this kind of society and things cost and you want to live the way you want to live, but also to take care of that family that you care about, you know, making sure they have what they need. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ron. And then you said that you also value your work ethic, because that's what provides you, that's part of your identity. Okay. That's what gives you your self-worth.
Yes.
Was I summarizing that right?
Yes, ma'am.
So we live in this country, and, you know, you made me think about when we introduce ourselves, quite often we say our name and we say what we do. That's part of the values of our country. I think we had two other people, then I'm going to go on. Tyler and then Diane. Is Tyler?
I think Tyler left, but Diane lowered her hand, but you could speak if you like, Diane, but Lee raised his hand.
Go ahead, Lee, and then Diane.
Okay. If Diane's okay. One thing I value more than a lot of things is security and our freedoms in this country and those that protect our freedoms in this country. The freedoms that we have, whether it's for our families, our freedom of speech, even with the H.R. 1134, you know, the freedoms that we have in this country that are protected by those that are in the armed services oftentimes go overlooked, because without those those individuals protecting our country, none of this that we're talking about today would not be possible. So that's one thing that I've learned to value as we go through our daily chores and our daily lives, is the freedom to stay from not being censored, the freedom that we have as just American citizens to go about freely to live some of the values that we just heard about. So that's what I really value is when you look at sometimes when I personally look at it, and being in the armed services and being on the front lines there, and being able to serve our country and our members of our citizens of our country with your life on the line, while people take that oftentimes on a daily basis, don't even think about it. But those are some of the securities that I believe in and that I value, not just for myself, but for my family, for my fellow man here in the United States of America.
And thank you, Lee. So valuing your freedom and the ability to be able to have these kind of conversations, right? You talk about censorship and being able to speak up, or, you know, and that is definitely things that are defended by our military. And we thank you for your service and important. I think we got Diane, then Marilyn, and then we're going to move on.
Marilyn's raised her hand.
Okay, go ahead, Marilyn.
All right. I value my faith and the ability to worship freely. Mm-hmm. I value history and I value advocacy in two ways. I value the ability to advocate for our civil rights and as individuals living with blindness and other disabilities. So my faith, our history, and advocacy in civil rights and disability issues.
Tell me why you value history.
If you do not know and respect history, the pros and cons, it is bound to repeat itself. And history teaches us where we are, where we have been, and where we are bound to go.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So when we think about these things, from what we heard just now, I would bet, not a betting person, but I would bet that everything that was just spoke about, every one of us on this call value. Okay. So the divisiveness that's meant to tear us apart, we need to keep our eye on the prize, because something that Lee said, you know, these values that we have are fragile in this pretty young democracy, in terms of the not only the values, the freedoms that we have are pretty fragile in this young democracy of ours. So it is critical that we think and keep our minds on, you know, not our differences, but where are we similar? And those are those things we talk about. So I come to you today to talk about critical race theory, what it is and what it is not, because that is what sparked a lot of the vitriol and legislation and some of the disinformation and miscommunications that's been going on. And so first and foremost, any of you, when we talk about inequities and racial inequities in particular, would you all agree with me that there are racial inequities in our living situation, you know, where we live, you know, that people of color are less likely to own their own homes than people, and let me say, for lack of better, white Americans. Would you agree with me that people of color have a mortality rate for maternal and infants and maternal mortality rate for women and children are higher for those people of color than it is white women and children? Would you also agree with me that the access to education and high quality education, there is a disparity between people of color and whites in this country? If you disagree with me on any of those, please raise your hand. Go ahead, Diane. If you are talking, we cannot hear you. Diane, okay. Okay, I'm sorry. My video is acting up. Give me one second. Can everybody still hear me? Lee, can you hear me?
Yes. I still hear you. You're good.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Okay. So so when we talk about critical race theory, that's simply the major emphasis of critical race theory. It's a framework that talks about or looks at, gives an analysis of the inequities and how those inequities are perpetuated in our society. It started in the 1960s. I'm sure there's been conversations, but it gained momentum in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in terms of looking at how our social and economic institutions have the laws, procedures, and practices that are embedded in racism. And those who in the those who are on the margins of society are continue to be impacted, you know, negatively. So I'm sure some of you've heard that term, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know. The comeback for that is, if I don't have boots, that's going to be kind of hard. The assumption that we all start in the same place, for example, all of us on this call, okay? All of us on this call may have blindness in common, but I would say to you that none of us, or most of us, you know, have started in different places. Some of us have more privileges than others, okay? So critical race theory is a framework for looking at the inequities and overcoming some of those inequities and those power dynamics to stop the status quo, you know, to change what's going on. I'm sorry, my phone is going nuts here. I'm sorry, give me one second. There are specific tenets of critical race theory that I want to talk about. So again, I said critical race theory provides a framework for looking at the persistence of these racial inequities that we all know exist. So the first tenet of critical race theory is race is a social construct, and the way that it is defined and experienced is a result of social and political thought and actions. Now, we talk about race and disability as if they really exist. I will tell you that both of those things are social constructs created by those in power, okay? Because, again, we are more similar than we are different. We may have shades, you know, of color, okay? But we are more similar than we are different. And when we talk about disability, from a social justice perspective, we are only as disabled as the context we're put in. So if I ask a room full of my colleagues, and for those who wear glasses or contacts, to take those things away, okay, some of them would have just as much issues as those who are blind, okay, because they're being put in a context, or we turn the light off. This is something that my sons, I have two boys that are always teasing me. It's like, Mom, why do you have the light off? I don't need it. Although I got to pay the bill, I don't need it. So, you know, I have a skill in walking around in the dark, but, you know, a lot of sighted folks, the first thing they do is turn the light on. Okay. So there are some recognizing the diverse range of, the whole range of human diversity is important. So to put that in context, that we create these differences for a reason. Race is the way to categorize, classify, and it's the same thing for disability. And it's the way they measure, you know, different things in different ways across our society. So we know in special ed, we have the different disability labels, and we make a big deal about those disability labels, and we, you know, different disability labels garner the districts a certain amount of money. Okay. And we know that people who have the power, I've been in education for, more than 30 years and, taught every level and almost every disability category. And I will share with you that parents with power and influence, have the ability to, have their child put in categories where there's a lot more funding and a lot more opportunity. And I'll say right now that's in the area of autism and formerly learning disability. But when you look at categories like severe emotional disturbance, that category has an overrepresentation of kids of color. So another inequity that we talk about that critical race theory helps us understand the, give me one second. I'm sorry, my computer jumped. CRT also tries to avoid this conflation of race and racist. One of the disinformation that I hear all the time when you turn the TV on and you've heard it at the school boards is that CRT is teaching the kids, you know, to hate white people. And that was definitely in this bill, 1134. It does just the opposite. As I said, the focus is on institutional processes, procedures that perpetuate inequities. It says nothing about racist point out any particular group for being racist. It talks about the institutional practices that, as a result of behavior or attitudes and bias, result in the inequities that we talk about. Tenet 3, because the differential treatment of individuals based on racial classification is embedded in our social systems and institutions, including public policies and law, racism is commonplace rather than rare. And we can say it just like ableism, racism, and all the other isms is as common as apple pie. Okay. Because they're embedded in the system. And we try to normalize that. We expect those who are not in the positions of power to navigate that. But it is challenging. And I think that's, again, why we're all here, because of the institutional policies and practices that are fundamentally racist. Okay. That continues to impact, you know, whether that keeps one group above another group. Let me say that. So it's systematic practices that ensure that certain groups, typically white males, are more likely to achieve those goals based on their values than another group. Those were three tenets. The fourth tenet of CRT, while racism is perpetuated in our structural and systems at the, say, macro level of society, listening to and understanding the lived experience of people, is essential for understanding how racism works to create inequities. So I just gave you four tenets of CRT, and we can look at those tenets across multiple areas, whether it's policing in this country, okay, who is police most? And they said, well, they're the ones, you know, shooting each other. Well, ask yourself the question, why? Where are these shootings happening? Are they happening in what we term ghettos or the projects, where the living conditions create situations where people are desperate to get food? You know, are they in those areas where there's scarce resources? Are they in the areas where there's a lot of resources? Okay. So asking yourself why those things are different, that's what CRT, it is a framework. This idea, and let me just say this, another misconception is that, oh, we were teaching this in our K-12 schools. I got 3 degrees, all of them from The Ohio State University, one of the largest, maybe second largest now, it goes back and forth, universities in the country. And not one course did I take or remember conversation, even in some of my multicultural classrooms, was CRT ever taught? It is a comes from legal studies, and it was a way to start examining some of these issues that have been perpetuated over time, and begin to act on some of those issues. And those are some of the challenges that we face. And so when we talk about, I think Jeff is the one mentioned about theory. In theory, there's a lot of things possible, right? But is it true? You know, and we know that, we know that just because something's a theory does not, or can possibly happen, doesn't mean it's happening. And that's the kind of thing that our educators are dealing with right now. Our children are dealing with right now. You know, we have a high degree of concern because without having the ability to examine and look at these things, in a systematic way, which is what, critical race theory allows us to do, then we will continue the status quo. And some folks may be comfortable with the status quo, but I give to you, there are more people who are not. And that's what this scramble to change and pass these laws right now, are about. I'm going to stop there and take questions. There's a lot more to be said. I'm providing resources, critical race theory. Before I stop, I want to talk about disability critical race theory. Over the last like it's 2013. In the last 10 years, let's say that, there has been, a move to look at, use critical race theory to look at the, impact, on, individuals with disabilities. And, disability critical race theory is one of those new, theoretical frameworks that, looks at how race and disability are, work together in interlocking, systems of oppression. This is something that's long been the case. Again, it's a way of analyzing how, society, the systems, and I will give you special ed as well. Systems of oppression, or policies and practices work, to perpetuate, the outcomes that we see. And so, you know, we wonder, you know, why are we putting all this money into these systems? And it seems like nothing's ever changing, because it's the systems, it's the institutional policies that create, perpetuate the inequities that we see, and the reason that we need to focus on those inequities in order to make change. Any questions?
Dr. Reed, I have a question. This is Lee. Uh-huh. And one of my questions, with the, what is and what isn't, when you hear about, shaming, I'm often hearing about, you know, one race being shamed, and, with the, education, of our students in the schools, and also now, you know, even in the libraries, you got, groups around the library in the country taking, challenging the libraries about some of the literature that they have, or books that they have in the libraries, and they demanding that these books and stuff be taken out because of shaming. Could you explain to me and others exactly what shaming is? I know we're over our time, but if you could quickly explain that and take a few other questions, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Again, this is, and I don't have time to talk about this, but I've talked about it in the past. We talk about racial identity development, and there's a difference between the racial identity development for Blacks and, or African Americans, and that of whites. And so, some of this shaming, we all go through this, these processes. And so we talk about shaming. It's not somebody shaming you. Okay. Part of the process of racial identity development for, and I'll talk about white specifically, is going through that process. They hear something, and, you know, they may be familiar with, you know, their culture, which makes sense. But then when they get into a situation where, you know, in an unfamiliar situation, maybe, and this often happens so when you go into, most of the time this happens when white children go off to college. One of my best friends said to me the first time she ever met a black person was in college, ended up being her roommate. And they got along great, but how fearful she was from all that she heard on TV and all these other things. So when they're referring to shaming, they got a little bit upside down. It's not that someone is trying to shame them. It's that when they learn of some of the atrocities that happen, we talk about slavery, when we talk about the experiences. And the first thing that came to my mind was the book by Toni Morrison, Beloved. It has nothing to do with, it was the story of a woman and her experience. Nowhere in the book does it try to shame anyone. It is a book about a woman and her experience. And, but they've made that into, you know, they're trying to shame us. Honestly, what we're trying, the whole goal of teaching these things in our schools is to teach empathy, to understand, as Marilyn pointed out, you know, history is important. So we know where we've been in order to get where we're going. And so they've got it a little backwards, because it's not someone shaming them. When something happens or someone in my family does something, right? Or in my ancestors, you know, you should feel a little bit of shame. And if you're going to feel a little bit of shame, then you're going to go make sure that doesn't happen in the future, or as much as possible. So there's no shaming going on, but through our social emotional learning, we want to teach children empathy, how to get along, perspective taking, et cetera. So does that answer your question, Lee?
Yes, ma'am. It answers it. And I know I need to study more on it, like everyone else. You know, I think that the session here, as we have gone over. Oh, so there's somebody else with a question.
Dr. Peters.
Go ahead, Dr. Peters. Ray. Dr. Peters, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I really didn't have a question, but Dr. Evie, I just wanted to thank you so much for sharing. You have great expertise, and we really respect that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray.
All right. Yeah, definitely. Thank you for sharing, and thank the committee for bringing this to our attention. I just really just wanted to touch on shaming, and just wanted to just give my experiences with, you know, shaming. And since critical race theory has become a real big topic across the country, and I'm just really growing up, you know, I grew up, you know, moved from Gary, and then I moved to Maryville, which was diverse and had a lot of different ethnicities. At the time, probably more Caucasians at the time. But when you talk about, you know, when they talk about, you know, slavery, and then they brought up, you know, history, as a young black male at the time, and not, you know, maybe me and another couple other, you know, young black male, you know, in the class, you know, our history was, you know, shrunken down to like a paragraph and a black man and some chains, you know. So to me, that felt, you know, kind of awkward. You know, I was kind of ashamed because, you know, I didn't know as much as I know now, but I know my history started before 1619. So, mm-hmm. You know, if you're not teaching it properly, you're going to be ashamed, you know, because of the thing that the imagery is definitely the imagery that stuck with you. So now, you know, we're dealing, you know, with prejudice, you know, that I'm dealing with as a young child, you know, not even knowing because it's covert at the time. So, but those type of things, yes. But I believe that if you're teaching it, you have to have someone that's going to be able to teach it correctly. I believe that, you know, it has to be their own special class in the sense, because some people are not going to teach history, you know, how history needs to be told. So that's just mm-hmm. not too sense.
No, I love that, because you raise a really important point that we need to remember is that our children, understanding their history, seeing themselves in books, and seeing themselves reflected in positive ways, as well as understanding there were struggles. And to me, to know that when this pandemic hit, I was able to go back and start reading about 1918. And oh my gosh, that was like, okay, we can make it. Our ancestors been through this, and this is what they did. And this is how they, you know, so that matters. It matters to not only our white children, it matters to our kids of color as well. And I think we can take one more, Lee.
Ron Brown.
Go ahead.
William. with a hand up.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Reed. I appreciate the topic, and probably in the future, can we, I really want to focus on what you talked about at the end of your presentation, and that's disability and critical race theory. The reason why I want to talk about that, because I think it's such an impactful development that you brought up, and that affects all of us on this call based on our blindness. And so my question to you, and you may not have time to answer it, is when you talked about disability and critical race theory, are you talking about the way that even the blind and others with disabilities fit on the hierarchical chart of where we stand with in our own disability and in the disability rights movement? And are you talking about things such as VOPE rehab and the way they do service delivery based on our disabilities? Because I know that a lot of blind people and people that serve of the blind feel that, you know, we're such a high impact disability that it's hard to get closures for us. And so I'm wondering, when you mention that, is this about the institutions and the way they deliver services and things of that nature?
You've hit it right on the money. Absolutely. And we can talk about it all day, Ron.
I know. That's why I said absolutely. I don't want to. We definitely got to hit that. We definitely. Yeah.
So that'll be the next chapter. Absolutely. Because it is those institutional practices. And when you ask it, why are we such a high impact? Why is it so hard to get us, you know, people employed who are blind or visually impaired? You know,
okay. And I think we had a William.
Yes.
A William. Okay. William.
Oh, thank you. I want to say good evening to you all from Ohio. Dr. Reed, this is an excellent presentation. And you were talking about the racism, dealing with those of us who are black and blind and have low vision. As a black man here in Cleveland, I've known persons of color that have low vision. They seem to have, for lack of a better word, hopelessness. You know, I can't get a job. Mm-hmm. I'm black. I'm blind. I can't see. I won't try. And I think that that's probably the case all over the country. So, and I know me and Dr. Peters have talked about this. I think, what can we do in the Federation to address this? Because I know Ron was just talking about the hierarchy, and I do believe there is a hierarchy. We may not want to talk about it out loud, but as quiet as kept, there is a hierarchy. And unfortunately, that keeps a lot of people of color down. So I think that that's something here in the Federation that we have to address as whites and people of color. And I'm not sure if you could answer, but how can we start to address this? Because this has a negative impact on this population. Excellent presentation.
Yeah, thank you so much. And William, thank you so much for your question. I would just begin by addressing that by saying it's called internalized racism. And so that is the byproduct of years and your live of internalizing to where you lose your self-worth. You feel like nothing matters, you know, that, you know, no one cares. You begin to operate in the way that you are perceived. I remember a professor telling me that when she was in school, very gifted individual, but so often, you know, she was coming against racism because she was very smart, didn't have to try hard to get stuff done. And after a while, she was always being accused of, you know, whatever they were accusing her of. So where she started acting out, doing the very things that they, you know, said to, she was like, okay, you want to call me, you know, this, then I'm just going to be that way. And so sometimes there's no way out. I will say, in terms of the Federation, what can we do? What we're doing right now, educating ourselves, educating the people in our networks, pushing back on the inequities, not just outside of the Federation, but within the Federation. You know what? You know, we've been having these conversations. We've started these DEI committees across the country. What we're doing right now is what we do, and make sure that our schools reflect and our books are reflecting that, you know, our people, you know, and specifically our males, have lots of successes. But if our kids never open a book and see people who look like them, where are they going to get that from? So, yeah, I love to keep this conversation going, but I know there, I want to be respectful. We're already over time, and Lee's mentioned it a couple of times, but let's keep this conversation going.
And in conclusion, I would like to say thank you all for taking the time and staying on with us. And as we have our DEI committee meetings across the country, many of our DEI meetings, we just have small numbers of people to attend. We have tried here within our state as well as across the country, other DEIs, but we know that this is kind of new to a lot of folks, or maybe some people may be rebellious against DEI and might not even understand why it exists. So it is incumbent upon us, as we have shared this evening, to you know, take what you have shared and see how we can continue to grow it. And as Mr. John Perret indicated, you can call our national president, and if you want to see some action taken, we got our second vice president on the call here, Mr. Ron Brown, and I'm sure that he can relay some of this information as we continue to try to get the information out, because that's one thing that we're all about is diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we need to make sure that we secure that within our own organization. So once again, we just want to thank you from the DEI committee of here in Indiana, and look forward to next month when we come on. We may continue this conversation. So thank you once again. You guys have a safe evening, and we look forward to talking with you in the very near future.